Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Thursday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. David French of National Review is in for Jim Garrity today. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We have good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives today, and all of it is brought to you by Quip. That's right, the Quip electric toothbrush starts at just $25, and if you go to getquip.com/martini, you'll also get your first refill pack free with your new Quip electric toothbrush. Again, getquip.com/martini. More on them a little bit later in our conversation. And David, we start off with good economic news, and not just one piece, but two pieces. First of all, from Bloomberg. U.S. filings for unemployment benefits unexpectedly fell last week to the lowest level since January 1973. Further evidence that the labor market remains tight, Labor Department figures showed Thursday. Here are the highlights of the report dealing with jobless claims from the week ending March 24th. Jobless claims decreased by 12,000 to 215,000. It was estimated that at this point it would be at 230,000, so in the better direction by 15,000 jobs. Continuing claims rose by 35,000 to 1.87 million in the week ending March 17th. And the four-week average of initial claims, a less volatile measure than the weekly figure, fell to 224,000 from the prior week's 225,000. So pretty much level there. Also, CNBC reporting U.S. consumer sentiment slipped slightly at the end of March after shooting up in the mid-month report, but still recorded its highest level since 2004. So, David, I guess time will tell whether Trump is actually going to end up pushing back against this momentum in our economy through tariffs and other action towards China and so forth. But the fact that we've got jobless numbers way down and consumer sentiment way up, that's really good.
Yeah, all of that is fantastic news. And, you know, look, there's been a long recovery since the incredible financial shock of 2008. And a lot of economists, smart economists, warned us all the way back then that it usually takes a really long time to fully recover from a financial shock of that magnitude. You know, I think that there were Obama policies that slowed down excessive regulation of the economy, the explosive growth of the regulatory state. But I think, you know, we were looking at a situation where we had such a almighty wallop in 2008. It was going to take time. And as I said, the smarter economists said it was going to take time. And what that has meant, I think, is it's just taken a long time for the overhang of that to be removed from the economy. There's been some things the Trump administration that has done that has helped, certainly more than hurt. But we'll see about the tariffs. But all of this is just really good news. And it's really good news to see that recovering optimism and that recovering sense that things are going to be okay financially. Things are going to be okay economically. And that's of enormous benefit to most everybody right now. It's been a long time coming. We knew it would be a long time coming, but it's nice to have it finally here.
And it's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy, right? Because some of those people in the consumer sentiment survey are probably business owners who think this might be a good time to grow and expand and perhaps add a new location somewhere. It could be people thinking their financial situation is better, so maybe they take on that home improvement project or do something that creates work, and it just kind of snowballs from there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, optimism breeds activity. Optimism breeds energy. And it absolutely can be self-fulfilling in the same way that pessimism is self-fulfilling. And pessimism can breed restraint, and pessimism can breed risk aversion. And, you know, look, that's not to say that we should always be optimistic. Sometimes optimism could breed excessive energy, as we saw in the housing market leading up to the crash. But these things are cyclical. They've always been cyclical. And we'll probably spend, you know, the rest of human existence trying to figure out a way to make sure that economies always grow. It will never really, truly be like that. You just hope that the overall arc is upward rather than stagnant.
I believe the term you're looking for, David, is irrational exuberance for people who are unnecessarily optimistic, from Alan Greenspan, who, of course, is the personification of exuberance.
Speaking of exuberance, you're beginning to see it in the housing market and it's one of the things that I've noticed, because we're actually in the process of buying a new house.
And oh, wow.
We're seeing small houses in Nashville, which is not normally known as a high cost city. It's relatively small houses in Nashville going for more than $1 million, which is just staggering to think about. And so part of that is look at all this energy and optimism. And then the other part of it is, look at all this energy and optimism. So there can be a little bit of irrational exuberance, but overall, it's good to see this confidence coming back.
Well, David, we're hundreds of miles apart, but it's good to see that insane housing prices are what come together to make us similar
here.
Yes, exactly. So let's go to our bad martini now. And for those who follow National Review closely and certainly follow folks like David and other National Review writers and editors online, on Twitter and so forth, you know that in recent days, Kevin Williamson, who has guest hosted on this podcast a number of times, has left National Review and is becoming a columnist over at The Atlantic. Sad times for National Review, but Kevin Williamson, of course, is known for being an exceptional talent, but The Atlantic generally trends to the left, and that some people at The Atlantic and some people just in liberal journalism in general are going apoplectic about the fact that somebody like Kevin Williamson had just got hired at The Atlantic. So, David, you have taken to National Review Online to defend your former colleague and your friend, and you say it's happening again, this time to a friend and former colleague. Once again, a prestige media publication, in this case The Atlantic, has hired a conservative writer and suffered immediate furious backlash. Once again, the publication's leadership is explaining itself to its own staff. And you say this has also happened with The New York Times and Bret Stephens and Barry Weiss and The Washington Post with Meghan McArdle. And so the main piece that triggered all this is Jordan Weissman in Slate demanding to know why The Atlantic would hire a conservative troll, as you point out. And then there's a sampling of all the different things that she thinks and other people think in other writings where Kevin is unacceptable. For example, he tweeted at one point that women should be hung if they have an abortion or something, if we're really going to treat it like murder and so forth. So as you point out in your piece, basically people, speaking of trolls, have gone through Kevin Williamson's material for the past decade, which is voluminous, found out the things that they think make him the most egregious, and have now put him on thin ice to the point where The Atlantic has put out a memo having to defend itself to its own staff.
This is so tedious and tiresome. I mean, it's this game. Here's Kevin, who is not only one of the most talented writers in the conservative world, he's one of the most talented writers in journalism, period, end of discussion. And is widely recognized right and left as one of the most talented writers, thoughtful writers, thought-provoking writers in working in journalism. I mean, the idea that, you know, now I'm not going to say Kevin on occasion hasn't trolled on Twitter, but I'm trying to imagine who hasn't on occasion trolled on Twitter. But to characterize that immense body of work and to call him a conservative troll is utterly absurd, utterly absurd. So what do? We go through this incredibly tedious exercise where you take a man who is known around the nation for his thoughtful work, comb through the millions of words he's written, the countless numbers of interviews that he's given, all the podcasts he's broadcast. Do you broadcast a podcast? I don't know. all the podcasts he's published, whatever you want to call it, and all the tweets he's written, and then you determine that there's a paragraph here, a tweet there, another paragraph here, and maybe a sentence there that in your mind are beyond the pale and not just worthy of criticism, which fine, criticize him. Rage tweet about him all day, every day, until Twitter mercifully dies. I don't care. But to say he shouldn't not just be criticized, but be fired from his new job. It's tedious, it's tiresome, it's intolerant, it's ludicrous, but that's where we are. And look, I look at this and I say, between Meghan McArdle and Bret Stephens and Barry Weiss, those three, Barry Weiss, Stephens, and McArdle, are hardly fire-breathing conservatives. You would call them center-right or center-libertarian-ish for Meghan McArdle. And they're hardly fire-breathing conservatives. They're hardly culture warriors. And yet their very presence at The Washington Post and New York Times has triggered enormous controversy. Then you have Kevin, who is an absolute, you know, rock-ribbed, libertarian-leaning conservative, and who also is one of the most talented people writing today. And if that group of four people are too controversial to be in mainstream media outlets, well, then who can be? I mean, really, who can be? And that's where we are. This is where we're reaching this point where it's not enough that these mainstream media outlets like the Atlantic, the Post, the Times, for some folks, are strongly left-leaning. The argument now is essentially that they have to be exclusively left in their commentary, or that if there's going to be any ideological diversity, it was the columnists on the right who were already there, and essentially no one else, no one more. And that's just that does real damage to the marketplace of ideas, and that does real damage to the quality of thought in the United States, because if all we're going to be doing is being pushed into our respective tribes and talking to each other in our respective cocoons, we're going to deal with more polarization and more intellectual stagnation.
I thought the left was the side of tolerance, David, for expanding different viewpoints and bringing in people who, making sure we have a full spectrum of views here.
Well, I mean, there are people on the left who are like that. They do exist, of course. But, you know, there is obviously a strain of the left that essentially says, if we believe you have a bad idea, then you should have no platform other than the one you create for yourself. This is sort of the defense when you say, why are you doing this to Kevin Williams? And they say, well, we're not depriving him of a platform. He can always be at National Review. Or let's say if you're a conservative scholar, they'll say, get thee to a Christian university. But they're saying you just can't have, and here's the crux of it, our platform. Now, here's the question. I get it if you're talking about Mother Jones or The Nation. Look, I get it. You know, these are publications founded as intentionally progressive. But is it going to be the case that every single part of media, including the op-ed pages of the legacy media, are now going to be completely and thoroughly balkanized? Is that what we want? Because that seems to be what at least some progressive activists want, that they want to view the New York Times editorial pages just as much a part of their tribe as they view sort of Mother Jones. I guess that would make what, the New York Times the super Mother Jones? super mother. But yeah, it really is pernicious to the notion of a working functional marketplace of ideas. And this is something I think is really important for Americans to understand. This is more than just inside media baseball about who gets what jobs. This is about, do we have spaces left where people in the same institution can engage in robust debate, and the same very important cultural institution can engage in robust debate, or is media going to go the way of higher education, where the prominent conservative voices are in any given institution are few and far between, if they exist at all?
Very well said, David. I do quibble with you a little bit. I think while they do, in fact, want to make sure that they purge all conservative voices out of what they think are their lanes, they are not necessarily content to leave you in the lane where you ought to be. And we're going to talk about that a little bit later in our Crazy Martini. But if you got a really bad taste in your mouth about the way the left is treating Kevin Williamson, we can't necessarily wave a magic wand and fix that. But we can get rid of the bad taste in your mouth. And we can do that with Quip toothbrushes, because when it comes to your health, brushing your teeth is one of the most important parts of your day. Quip knows that. They've combined dentistry and design to make a better electric toothbrush. And Jim is the one who drew the long straw on this product. And he can tell you, as he has many times in this podcast, that he got the Quip electric toothbrush. He loves it. It's nice. It's light. It's inexpensive. It gives you a nice guide to explain how to brush your teeth, which is different than how most people think you ought to, the right amount of toothpaste to use and so forth. There's just so much to know about Quip. So let's tell you a little bit about it. Quip is the new electric toothbrush that packs just the right amount of vibrations into a slimmer design at a fraction of the cost of those bulkier traditional electric brushes. And it's got the guiding pulses that alert you when to switch sides, which makes brushing the right amount absolutely effortless.
Oh, and by the way, I have one of these too.
Oh, great.
So it's fantastic toothbrush. Quip also comes with a mount that suctions right to your mirror and unsticks to use as a cover for hygienic travel anywhere, which I do use for travel, whether it's going in your gym bag or you're carrying on. And because the thing that cleans your mouth should also be clean, Quip subscription plan refreshes your brush on a dentist-recommended schedule, delivering new brush heads every 3 months for just $5, including free shipping worldwide. Quip is backed by a network of over 10,000 dental professionals, including dentists, hygienists, and dental students.
I'm still marveling about free shipping anywhere in the world, but most toothbrushes don't get named one of Time Magazine's best inventions of the year, but Quip did. So find out for yourself why it's so special. Once again, Quip starts at just $25, and if you go to getquip.com/martini right now, or at the end of the podcast, you'll get your first refill pack free with a Quip electric toothbrush. That's your first refill pack free at getquip.com/martini. That's spelled getquip.com/martini. All right, David, let's move on to our crazy martini and the cryptic forecast I gave just a little bit ago. Details a story from Planned Parenthood, specifically a Pennsylvania chapter, and what they would like to do to Disney princesses. This is the USA Today version of the story. A Planned Parenthood branch in Pennsylvania called for the Walt Disney Company to create an animated princess, quote, who's had an abortion, in a since-deleted tweet post Tuesday. Planned Parenthood Keystone, a branch of the health service provider based in Trexlertown, Pennsylvania, tweeted that, quote, we need a Disney princess who's had an abortion. We need a Disney princess who's pro-choice. We need a Disney princess who's an undocumented immigrant. We need a Disney princess who's actually a union worker. We need a Disney princess who's trans, unquote. So they've deleted the tweet. The national headquarters has made it kind of clear they didn't think this was necessarily the smartest move in the world. David, you've got daughters. I've got two daughters, 5 and 3. So they're right in the target audience here for Disney movies. My three-year-old literally rotates day by day among Snow White dresses, Belle, Cinderella, and Rapunzel. So, I mean, the idealism these kids have for these Disney princesses cannot be underestimated. And it's going to be soon enough where they're off in school and off into the world, and they have to deal with the muck that we talk about every single day among their classmates and so forth. And to have this little oasis where they are right now is really, really nice. And it's not the first time that the left has tried to hijack the innocence of the Disney princess movement. I remember when they announced there was going to be a sequel to Frozen, there was this give Elsa a girlfriend hashtag that went around at the time. And so the fact that they want to infiltrate this innocent part of childhood is annoying on the surface, of course, but it's just another example of how the left wants to wedge itself into every single part of the culture and make sure that the indoctrination is unavoidable.
Yeah, it is. It's not just the politicization of everything. It's the radicalization of everything. Because, I mean, most of the Disney princesses are like young teens, you know, in right. in their respective worlds, they're like young teens. So I just wonder, I'm like trying to figure out what's the scenario for the UAW trans Disney princess that isn't also violating, child labor laws. I mean, it's unbelievable. It's unbelievable. But this is the wave of the future. And here's what I'm afraid of. What I'm afraid of is that as you have the current an increased fragmentization of American media and the carving out of very specific media spaces, that you're going to have fewer and fewer spaces where sort of everybody comes together, because you can put together a pretty darn viable business model serving up content to blue America and a pretty darn viable business model serving up content to red America, and never the twain shall meet. And you know, Disney is still one of those common spaces, relatively common spaces. I mean, you know, my youngest daughter loves Disney Channel. We love our favorite vacation or Disney cruises. They're a great time. There are still a few companies or a few businesses that their business model depends on reaching out to red and blue. And it's not surprising, given that immense cultural power theoretically that they wield, that the left targets these entities for maximum pressure. And it's not just Disney, it's also, for example, the NFL. The NFL's business model depends on reaching an awful lot of red and blue Americans. In the NFL, we have seen the political swamp that the NFL's fallen into over the last, 2 years. And this is nuts, it's silly, but it's also ominous at the same time. Because again, this isn't just politicization. I mean, at this point, we're used to the politicization of Disney. I mean, Disney politicizes itself, at least to a degree. This is the radicalization, not just the politicization. And that kind of step is the kind of thing that I think means that it's just gonna get worse before it gets better, if it gets better at all.
Yeah, good point. Sports was another area where we're supposed to get a nice oasis from politics. ESPN and other outlets have certainly destroyed that. And David, just looking at the list, you explained why Disney princesses would not be in the pro-choice market since they're teenagers. And a couple others here, undocumented immigrant and a union worker. If you're a princess, you're from a royal family, so I'm not sure how you're going to be an undocumented immigrant in whatever kingdom you're in. And usually royal families would be management, not labor.
That's very, very true. I do suppose you could be if your royal family in a nation that has been, sacked and pillaged by war, you could be a refugee. The child entertainment possibilities of that kind of scenario are just endless, aren't they? I mean, it's utterly, there are so many ways. There are so many ways to spread your agenda, so many ways to inject that into programming aimed at amusing and inspiring 10-year-olds is really unbelievable. It's really unbelievable. This is of course a company that's already kind of pushing the red line on politics. They're talking to a company that's already pushing the red line on politics, and therefore is, I think, uniquely susceptible to this kind of view. Now, obviously, this tweet went too far even for the National Planned Parenthood, or it wouldn't have been deleted. So it's not like we're going to have, trans union princess anytime soon. But this is reflective of a particular mindset, and it's a reflective of a mindset that's particularly influential in our cultural centers in our major coastal cities.
Well, David, I sincerely hope that if there is any sort of union labor in the next Disney movie, that it's at least a right to work kingdom. I got enough issues with the princesses that do exist. I got the girls that love Ariel, and I'm like, look, Ariel made a deal with the sea witch because she fell in love with a guy she never even met yet. There's enough issues going on already with Disney princesses that we don't need to inject all this stuff in here.
Well, they do get themselves into predicaments all the time.
This is a conversation I could have not had 6 years ago, anything related to Disney princesses. But glad to know that I've got that nuance now in my arsenal. David, good to have you with us. As always, happy Easter to you, and we'll talk to you soon.
Happy Easter to you, and thanks for having me.
David French of National Review, in for Jim Garrity today. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. There will be no Three Martini Lunch on Friday in observance of Good Friday. We'll be back on Monday. Jim will be back then for the next edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Until then, you can follow us on Twitter at Jim Garrity. I'm at @Dateline_DC. David is at David A. French on Twitter. And don't forget to visit our good friends over at Quip. For just $25, you can go to getquip.com/martini, order your toothbrush, and your first refill pack of brushes is free. Getquip.com/martini. Once again, thanks for being with us today. Have a wonderful Easter, everyone, and we'll see you Monday for the next Three Martini Lunch.